Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Here we are. I'd like to think that I'm one of the chief progressive persuaders on this Tuesday, the first day of June of year 2021. Thank you so much, Brian Brown, for your introduction. It's always so welcome to hear your voice and your inspiration for the Brown Briefly. So we have five Brieflies joining us today and looking forward to some entertainment and some observations and some local news, as well as some maybe just a little global introspection. But before we start off with Truman O'Brien, Bruce Hallman, Gail Kellner, and Lynn Kerrigan, I want to recognize that yesterday was Memorial Day and a time of recognition of the service of veterans and veterans' families to the safety of the country. And I think that our local Briefly veteran group is Truman O'Brien. So let's see, are there any other veterans in the Brieflies? No, so Truman,
I think I met.
Pardon me?
I said, I think I'm it.
I think you am. you know, I was thinking about, because I know that I reached out to you about some wood milling, and I noted that you were a member of the Island.
Forest Stewards, yeah.
Island Forest Stewards. And I think I saw a blurb that you were also involved with the airport district on Vachon.
I'm a commissioner, yeah.
Commissioner, there you go.
Yeah,
okay, I
yeah.
thought that was it. And then, of course, you've been helping with the vaccinations, the COVID vaccinations, as many others have on Vachon. And, of course, you're a voice of Vachon. So where did this passion for service come from? Is it something was intrinsic to your military experience, or did you carry this passion with you into that?
No, I think it's been with me for my whole life. I've always, you know, I belonged to Key Club when I was in high school, which is a service organization. And I don't know. I've just been, it's been part of my nature, I guess. I don't know how to explain it, but I always felt obligated to give back, you know, to the community and to the folks that did good things for me. And so it's just a way of giving back, you know.
So all right. So good genetics or good parenting or both?
Well, I hope. Yeah.
All right. And I know that Gail mentioned that she is of a military family as well.
Long time back, not myself personally, but my father was fought in Korea, or was stationed there. And then my great grandfather was a Civil War soldier on the Union side. There's a lot of family lore and history around that, including some wonderful old letters where he talks about he was actually injured, but it wasn't by gunfire, but by the explosion on a train of, you know, they were steam trains at that. Many of them were steam trains at the time, and the explosion on a steam train. So,
wow.
Shrapnel from that.
Amazing. And I know, Lynn, of course, you have been very involved in local service on Vachon with first respond or the, you know, the Vachon Be Prepared and other things. But Lynn, what's on your mind?
You know, what I just wanted to mention, and also to thank Truman and anybody who or whose family served, is that I think that for me, I grew up in that Kennedy generation, really inspired by his kind of provocative statement to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Yep. And I'd like to see a more national service, whether it's in the military or the Conservation Corps or the Peace Corps, or some way of involving younger people in not just politics, but in our country and the positive things that can be achieved, you know, when you give to your community. I think it's incredibly wonderful, and it's given me a lot of richness in my life. So thanks, Truman.
No, thank you, Lynn. And, you know, I just, we've talked about this before, about how important a mandatory service of some kind would be for the first 2 years out of high school, or maybe the first 2 years after your 2 years of college or something. But, one of the things that we were talking about earlier was the developing new rituals around patriotism and all of those, the way of our democracy. And I thought, well, you know what? It just kind of came together for me just now to say, wow, there's a way to start that new ritual, you know, of community service. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Maybe merit badges of your life
there you go.
Kind of come to mind. Yeah. Bruce, it seems like you've been an advocate also of sort of mandatory service. Do I recall that correctly?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a family that was very involved in the community, and so sort of got that from just throughout my life, but also in terms of service. Well, I was that in-between generation for Korea and Vietnam. My father, grandfather, aunts, uncles, aunts, back to the Civil War have served, and up through the current wars in the Middle East, cousins and have served. And what's unbelievable almost is they've all come back. None have been killed in service. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, when you look at the Civil War veterans, it's the mortality rate was pretty high. So, there's a sort of an angel of good hanging over the home and family. Thank goodness.
Yes. Gail, I think you had a comment.
Oh, I just wanted to acknowledge the service that Truman and others have given through military service, which is, the Memorial Day grew out of that after the Civil War, is my understanding. And Bruce, you could speak more deeply about that. The Civil War was such a very bloody war, very long, very bloody, a lot of deaths. And it was, my understanding is it rose up in small communities all over the country to just simply go to the cemeteries and begin to mourn their dead and remember them. And so I just wanted to add that little thought. So Bruce, do you have more to add, or Lynn?
Yeah, just, Dedication Day, Remembrance Day, really began in the 1840s and 1850s in some towns in New England. Mainly around Revolutionary War dead, but particularly after, you're right, Gail, after the Civil War, it began to become a national movement and ultimately grew into what we have today, Memorial Day. But it's a long sort of tradition. But the Civil War sort of kicked it into high gear, if you will, just because of the number of dead on both sides, but particularly on the Union side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lynn.
It was a great new ritual that I've seen started on television, actually, where there has been a movement on Memorial Day for at 3 p.m. all the people who are musicians to stand outside and play taps at 3 p.m. on Memorial Day. I forgot it at 3 p.m., but I went out later in the evening before I went to bed and on my little Irish penny whistle played taps. And actually, it was this wonderful feeling in the still of the night to hear those, wonderful lamenting notes go out over KVI. I don't know if you could hear it, Bruce, but, the sound carries. And it's a very simple song that, they showed photos of all the bagpipers, all the trumpeters, people that are learning how to play taps so they can be involved in this kind of community ritual. We talk about what kinds of things draw us together and kind of can give us feeling for our country that, feels sometimes to be missing. And I was very inspired by having the opportunity to do that. Gail.
When I was a child, we spent Memorial Day with my mother and my grandmother and my older siblings. All of us would gather in the station wagon. My mother would fill it with flowers. And the back of the station wagon was absolutely full of the rhododendrons and all of the flowers from the yards. And we would go and visit all the grave sites of our relatives in around the area. So we usually went to at least three cemeteries sometimes more than that. And I just, you know, we lack that tradition, unfortunately, of remembrance. And I would love to see that sparked again on Memorial Day, not just of our people who served in the military, but I want to give a shout out to just all of the women that have served in so many ways, silently, unrecognized, unpaid, for generation after generation. And it's nice to remember those who've come before us who've given so much.
I have to tell you just a very, very short, funny story where you're talking about visiting the cemetery and the stones. My grandmother, years and years and years ago, my grandmother wanted to go to this little tiny cemetery that was in a little town in West Texas because she wanted to find the grave of a relative. And so the whole family went, my two brothers, myself, my parents, and my grandmother. And we spread out around the cemetery looking for this grave. And you would hear somebody all of a sudden start laughing. We think, what's going on? And then pretty soon somebody else would start laughing. And as it turns out, we all came together and we walked around and there were some of the funniest things written on these headstones. We laughed all afternoon and we were kind of embarrassed, you know, to be in a cemetery, everyone laughing, but it was hilarious. I mean, I'm telling you, I still remember that. That was just a little kid, you know.
They wanted you to laugh if they put something funny on their tombstone.
I have to tell you just this one. There were like four monuments that were identical. And then there was a larger one of that same style. And the first one said, Mrs. John Jones, you know, the date of birth, the date of death, gone but not forgotten. The next one said, Mrs. John Jones, with the death, gone but not forgotten, Mrs. John Jones. And finally, there was Mr. John Jones was the big one at the end. But I think of our four wives before he died. We were dying, and it was just too funny.
It is amazing what you can discover in cemeteries. Vashon Cemetery is no different than any others. Yeah. I remember the Japanese maple at the Matsuda family gravesite and discovered some names that are, you know, people that I know on Vashon who have clearly been here longer than I,
right.
Because they have family there interred.
Yeah.
So, well, and if I can interject, I mean, this year is the 100th anniversary of installing the monument to veterans in the Vashon Cemetery. Oh. And if you haven't been in there, it's worth going in and looking at that. It's the original monument recognized the Civil War veterans, the Cuban War veterans, which is the Spanish-American War, the Great War, or the World War. They just called it the World War at that time. This was 1921. And then the unknown. And then later, they put a block underneath that, and they recognized the veterans of World War II, Korea, you know, Grenada, you know, just on and all through the current war in the Middle East, which they call the War on Terror. So it's a really touching kind of thing. But every year, there's a ceremony at the Vashon Cemetery on Memorial Day, and it's very touching. If you haven't been to it, it's well worth taking some time. They usually do it at noon on Memorial Day.
Bruce, can I take this opportunity to ask you, you know, I know there's another monument down at Monument Road, you know, in the corner of Quartermaster Harbor. Is that a similar kind of memorial, you know, marker, or is it different than the one that's now in the cemetery?
No, it's the one on Monument Road is to recognize the first Euro-American settlers to the island. And what there isn't is a monument to recognize the Schwababsch native people.
Who were here, no kidding.
You know, 4,000 to 6,000 years or longer. But there is actually a group working to with the Puyallup tribe to potentially build a memorial longhouse on Vashon Island, portage area to recognize the Shwabop native people and their long sort of stewardship of the island. And there's their presence, they're still here. I mean, many people sort of think, well, you know, that was then, this is now, you know, there's native people were a part of the past. Well, they're still a vibrant part of our present.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I know Julia Lakey's been involved with some projects to recognize this Fobops tribe on Vashon. So good for those who are recognizing that heritage amongst us. So thank you, Truman, for your service to the military veterans, the families, the unsung heroes who deal not only with the departures, but the stress and the uncertainty. And still carry on so that we can have a nation defended. So kudos to all, and certainly very well deserved. Let's see, Lynn.
I wanted to go next to
a topic you brought up last week, but what else would you like to add?
I just wanted to add to what you're saying, the Public Health Service, because that is operating right now as we speak with the Medical Reserve Corps, which is the parties that I'd belonged to since 2008, following my kind of public health medical background. And it's the generosity of all of those people banding together under a public health mandate through FEMA to turn out to address this current pandemic. And I've been very impressed with the way they've organized and managed, you know, the vaccinations and the testing. And I just think it's important to say the Public Health Service is an alternative service and it's up and running and useful every day. So thanks, guys.
Absolutely.
And women.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Here.
Yeah. Sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. Fantastic. Yes, I'm glad that you were able to bring that up. You know, civilization's complicated and there's so many parts that go unseen but are so fundamental to how we live our lives. Speaking of how we live our lives and how others live our lives differently, at the end of last week's Brown Briefly, we were left with kind of a cliffhanger discussion of freedom. And, you know, today we're having discussions in Congress about infrastructure and what it means. So these terms often have different connotations for folks, including Truman, the story that you told of your friend visiting from England who found Americans were less free than they thought. I'm just curious, since we didn't have time to get into that, what any particular areas that your friend mentioned
about us? You know, I thought about that quite a bit after saying that, and I think what really was getting to her was the fact that our country is such a litigious society that we have so many no shoes, no shirt, no service. There's so many things that we are warned about or that we have to do just because we're afraid of getting sued. And I think that was one of the big things. I'm thinking in particular, I was at Peñíscola in Spain years ago. There was a big castle there right on the Mediterranean. And at the top of that castle, I can't remember what you call this now. My buddy Craig would correct me, but where you have the little the square top around the castle. There's a name for that castle.
Crenellations.
That's it. Thank you.
Crenellated.
Crenellation. That's it. That's it. Anyway, they were all wide open, and some of them were like 2 feet high, and some of them were like 5 feet high. But it was all wide open. You know, you could easily walk over and trip and fall, you know, hundreds of feet to your death. And I thought, wow, you would never see that in the U.S., but it's that sort of thing. You know, I mean, in Europe, they're saying, hey, you know, you be responsible for yourself. We're not going to look out for you. It's up to you. And boy, that's absolutely not the case here. Everybody's trying to protect you from yourself here, you know.
Yes. Well, Bruce, you, of course, spend a fair amount of time in the Southern Hemisphere, and I'm curious what your observations are relative to sort of freedom and constraint and litigation in maybe New Zealand and Australia relative to us here in America.
Yeah, I think Sherman really touches on something. One thing New Zealand has done is they've eliminated tort law. You can't sue anybody. They have what they've established, what they call an accident commission. So if you're in an accident and you're injured, it goes to the accident commission, and they use actuarial tables and income tables and all that stuff, and they come up with a settlement. Mm-hmm. And you can appeal it, but it's all done by a commission, not in a litigious sort of confrontational courts arrangement. The other thing I find, both in Australia and New Zealand, I mean, there's a fascinating book that was written in 2012, so getting on close to 10 years ago, by David Hackett Fisher, a political scientist who was visiting New Zealand in the early 2000s on a Fulbright. And he was there during an election campaign, and he noticed how similar the language was in terms of election campaigns in New Zealand and the United States, but how different the meanings were. Oh. And his, in his book, Fairness and Freedom, I mean, Freedom and Fairness, is really about that. And he traces it back to the fact that the United States was settled at a time when Britain, largely by people from Great Britain, and so was New Zealand, so was Australia. They're what we call, what historians call British settler societies, you know, so they're sort of the product of British, the British diaspora, if you will. But the United States was settled at a time when Britain was racked by civil wars. And largely one basis was religious civil wars, but also political civil wars. And so freedom in the United States becomes very much associated with the individual. You know, my freedom to bear arms, my freedom to religion, my freedom to speech. New Zealand, not really settled until the 1830s and 40s, when Britain is in the middle of an industrial revolution, and the rights of individuals, the rights of workers have come to the forefront, the Charterist movement, things like that. And so what you get in New Zealand is a focus on freedom, but freedom with responsibility and with fairness. Hmm. So that, you know, you have the right to bear arms, but you don't have the right to, you only have the right to bear arms if you need them. You know, if you're a farmer and you're hunting foxes or rabbits or whatever, you can have a long gun, but you can't have an AK-47. You know, if you live in a city, you can have a handgun, you can have a long gun, but they need to be registered, they need to be locked away, the ammunition needs to be stored in a separate place. And they just, you know, you can be a member of a gun club and that kind of stuff, but people don't walk around with guns. They don't have an open carry law. They don't even have a closed carry law. They have no carry law. You know, you're not allowed to have guns, basically. And what you see is you don't see the level of gun violence in those cultures that you see here. And it's because they're really focused on the idea of responsibility and fairness, rather than my individual freedom to do whatever I want. That's a significant difference.
Significant.
You know, what strikes me is having the responsibility to come up with some topics of discussion for today's show. And, you know, we put in a script, let's just open this door and see what's there. And it's always just amazing how much is there. So thank you for that. Gail.
I just wanted to add on to what Bruce was saying. You know, this it seems to be a tension between rights of the individual and responsibility to the group. And that what happens is something that's known as the commons, which is whatever we all share together, the oceans, the air. You know, at one time that referred in England to before the enclosures, before it was the open land that everyone shared, hunted on. And so there was what was brought over in from the founders was this idea that they had the idea that the United States was open. There was lots of resources. And so there was this idea, no one needs to tell me anything because I can take whatever I want because there's more than enough and it can't be damaged. And you can see what that kind of individual freedom led to was incredible environmental degradation, taking of land that didn't belong to us, and the general, you know, the really for, I hate to use this word, but I think it might be appropriate, the raping of the oceans and the pollution of the sky. And this just, this environmental crisis that we're now in is in large part stemming from this idea that I can do whatever I would like. And I'm not responsible to the common, to the commons and to the other people engaged.
Yeah, Lynn, I think you had a comment in there, Bruce.
Yeah, I do. I, to build on that too, Gail, I'm thinking about that book I've talked about here before called American Nations that emphasizes that, you know, America wasn't all settled at the same time. And in fact, by a lot of different groups, the Massachusetts Bay Colony Puritans came here with a mind to reform and did believe that government, you know, was an opportunity to serve people better and vice versa. Whereas a lot of the people who settled the West in particular were ahead of the law. They settled before there were laws out there, before there were states, and, you know, they were on their own and made their own laws. And so I just think we have this patchwork of people with different ideas about their binding themselves to the land. Who is it that they're binding themselves to? You know, a lot of different ideas are in competition in America. And Bruce, I saw your hand go up too.
But the American historians of the American West talk about it as a Daniel Boone paradox. Daniel Boone would open up new territory, discover new paths across the mountain. And he was constantly pushed westward because he didn't want to be around other people. He wanted to be on his own. And the paradox, of course, is that every time he opened up a trail, he opened it up to other people coming. And so he was continually pushed further and further westward because he opened up this territory. And it sort of becomes the tragedy of the commons, an essay that from the 1960s that talks about that sort of way that we tend to abuse what we see in common, what we hold in common, because we don't see anybody responsible for it. Lynn, what you were talking about is really fascinating when you compare the settlement of the American West with the settlement of the Canadian West. Canada would not open up new territory until the Mounties had gone in and sort of established some kind of structure of law. Stability. Ah. You know, in the American West, settlers went in and they established their own law, sort of like Atlantic justice. And that's why you see very different attitudes in Canada and the United States about political action, about carrying guns. You know, and it's just because of the way that the West was opened up in Canada versus the way the West was opened up in the United States.
Oh,
it's amazing then how that culture just permeates and is durable. Gail, what are your thoughts?
This would add, I think that this is one of the tensions in our country right now between Democrats and Republicans is Democrats see it as a role of government not only to protect the commons, but to protect the common people. And I think that a more, perhaps more right view of it, right wing view of it is, you know, the individual freedom and rights to do what I want, to make as much money as I can, and with relatively little regulation with regard to workers' rights or the impact on the environment.
That is a fantastic segue into another topic I wanted to discuss today. But before we go there, I'll say one last thing. I remember, and this may date me, but Alvin Toffler's Future Shock, where the notion of over-choice was raised. And so as we think about freedoms, and I think Toffler asserted that, you know, folks who don't have that kind of product choice in a, you know, capitalistic free market like the United States, view that as a erosion of their freedoms to make simple decisions that I need some bread, there it is. I need a car. That's the one, right? As opposed to this hand-wringing of, oh, now I have to make multiple choices. So anyway, freedom's an intriguing thing. But let's see, but to politics at the national level, bringing back from the global perspective, no independent commission to investigate the Capitol building insurrection, at least not at this point. So what do we think? Is this going to move the moderate Democrats to abandon all hope of bipartisanship? Is what's Joe Manchin thinking at this point? Will that abandonment of hope lead to ending the Senate filibuster? Where do we think we're headed next?
You know, it's really interesting. When I first heard about the Republicans, you know, not supporting it, I thought, what in the heck are they thinking? I mean, good Lord, they were, you know, are they afraid of this or what? And then I heard one of the Republicans saying, well, this is really a matter for the DOJ rather than Congress. And I thought, well, I think that's a little bit of a a little bit of a stretch, but at least I get an idea of what they're talking about. I don't agree with that. I think they need to have a full bipartisan commission that goes in and looks at the whole darn thing. But and I really hate. I mean, I think the Republicans giving that up have really opened themselves up because the Democrats never can control the narrative completely, and you know they can make it go any way they want at this point. So anyway, I think it was just a stupid mistake on the Republicans' part.
Yeah, Gail, what do you think? Or Lynn, I'm sorry, what do you think?
You know, the simplest thing that flies to my mind when I think about this is I don't think the foxes are very good at guarding the hen house. And really, I mean, you know, Truman, you know, I think that was an interesting statement about now Democrats will control the narrative. Yeah. But, you know, what I'm looking at is that the Senate seems to have all the power in determining, you know, what kind of investigations go forward. And I'm just curious and hopeful that some other type of presidential commission or something will be established to try to, I'm not sure what. I feel like we all saw it on television. You know, I know what happened. And to deny what happened and the responsibility that responsibility sits somewhere, you know, is laughable to me. I think the French call it risible. And I love that word.
Well,
I am hopeful that at some point we'll be able to put the big lie to rest about who won the election and kind of get people to stop calling people to action over that particular idea and event. You know, to see that insurrection as the ultimate patriotism is disturbing to me.
Well, the one that gets me is, I'm sorry, I don't remember the senator's name or where he's from, but the guy who said, oh, yeah, they were just look like normal visitors if you didn't know it was, you know, what was going on. And then it shows a picture of him barricading, you know, behind the barricade. Yeah. I want to go, come on. What? Good Lord. When you were talking about seeing it on television, I mean, there it is, black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're still courting the big lie. And Bruce, historically, these are these sort of incidents cause major change in other countries. And what any thoughts from your perspective on the big lie and how long it's lived?
Oh yeah, I mean there's big lies and lots of big lies in American history. And one of the ways, I mean, you don't totally suppress it, but one of the ways is presidential commission like the Warren Commission to investigate the assassination of JFK. You know, the 9/11 Commission was under George Bush passed through Congress and became a presidential commission with congressional approval. But they don't need to be. The Warren Commission was established by executive order by Lyndon Johnson. So there's lots of examples of ways to go. But to leave this unexamined and to not look at the truth behind this. And I mean, conspiracy theories still, you know, swirl around the Kennedy assassination. But at least you have some, you know, record of, you know, they've gone through the records, they've gone through all the evidence and come up to a commission's conclusion. And that's essential here. If we're ever going to have a rule of law, if we're ever going to have a democracy based on truth and not based on emotion, you've got to do something like this. And so whether it works its way through Congress and the filibuster is eliminated and it passes through the Senate, or whether it's created by Biden as a Biden commission, or whether the House of Representatives does it on their own. There has to be an examination of January 6th. Because if without it, you're going to have, you know, you're going to have a credible sort of argument, sort of like the Wuhan, you know, virus. You know, where did it originate? You know, that's the nature of science, you know, and evidence. So I think it's essential that we do something.
I agree.
Yeah, it certainly seems that those who are not willing to go forward are sort of, you wonder about their own culpability. And of course, that's a not a, there's, you know, how much evidence is, it varies with which person in you're talking about, but that certainly has to come to mind. And I agree also that, you know, those who are going to conduct the investigation are now going to control the narrative. And I hope it doesn't turn into, you know, the left wing's example of the right wing's Benghazi. And I do think that it's a search for truth as opposed to a search for political advantage. I guess it's all for us to see, you know, how we go forward.
But also important to remember, I mean, the consequences of this, unlike most other presidential commissions, is those involved are guilty of treason.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
And so there's a level of significance here that you didn't get with the 9/11 commission. I mean, it was clearly 9/11 commission was outside, an outside attack on the United States. Clearly within in the JFK assassination. It may have or may not have been a conspiracy, but it was a very limited conspiracy. This was broad-based, you know, and it delves into the very heart of the American government and into elected officials who are treasonous. And the consequences of that are going to be significant.
Well, and not to forget that the very, very president himself, culpability in this at the time, just makes it such a standout among among this kind of inquiry.
One of the elected officials.
Yep. Right.
But not the only one.
Yeah.
Right.
Let exactly. Me ask and you know, it question. Seems. Oh, go ahead, Lynn. Sorry. Yeah,
I'm
Lynn,
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask a question of what type of authority a presidential commission or any type of further investigation that's not, you know, from the legislature itself, what kind of authority does it carry? And I'm thinking again of the Mueller report, you know, after several other Trump kind of egregious acts, that was, the Mueller report was just kind of blown off, you know, the people in power didn't want to listen to it. They didn't care. And so I think I had hoped that the Congress was open-minded enough to take this on and basically distance themselves a little bit from that kind of revolutionary, treasonous kind of behavior. And, you know, I think there's risk no matter what kind of happens about what how this information gets out, whether it's buried, whether it's listened to, and whether it's able to change the division that we have here. You know, what do you think about, you know, that kind of question about the significance and the outcome of any kind of commission?
Well, important to remember, I mean, a commission like any of these commissions, 9/11, JFK, Benghazi, whatever, I mean, those commissions are not for the now, they're for the future.
There you go.
Really establishing the historical record. Because, you know, the president is caught up in all kinds of emotions. But even a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, that's when the value of these kinds of commissions and their findings and laying out the evidence. Because we won't always be in the realm of a sort of fantasy, you know, big lie. Those don't hold up for long. They ultimately collapse under their own weight, and you know, or they become successful and establish a new regime that will dominate for a while, but ultimately fall. So, you know, as a historian, I always take the long view and sort of step back and say, "Yeah, wow, we're in for a rough go here." But within the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be in a very different situation, and people will look back at this, and I hope recognize how close we were to a disaster in terms of our democracy collapsing around us.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the value of these findings of commissions into the future, because I was thinking that there's a trend line of the step that from what happened in Michigan, where their capital was occupied, to what happened in the U.S. Capitol. And I don't know if those indicate that people are trying to figure out how far they can go, but that's real data. And they're, and without an investigation, I think it's hard to say whether or not this is, was, if Michigan was a trial step and a lesson learned to be more effective now at the U.S. Capitol and what could come next. So I don't want to become a fearmonger, but I think I want to become a reality monger. That we probably really do need to spend some time understanding what happened, who the motivators were, and find a way to again to work so that we can mitigate these occurrences in the future. I hate one last topic before we go. Our own Susan McCabe, I thought, had a quite insightful article in last week's Beachcomber about the Vashon High School Racial Equity PAC. And I knew that we had an increasingly large population of students of color in the student body. 25% is the number that Susan cited. And she also pointed out that Vashon High School staff is 99% white. So what do we think? Do we envision a shift happening? How necessary is it? What are people's thoughts about that? Bruce, I'm kind of curious too about you as an educator. What do you see as the importance? How critical is it that we move in that direction?
Oh, I think it's very critical. I mean, it's critical for people to see themselves represented in government, in positions of power, positions of authority. The one of the difficulties in the United States is that it's always been a white culture, and that's changing. And that's part of the struggle we're seeing, and the sort of the emotions of the struggle we're seeing. But I think also interesting to look at, and we'll know in September. So September Brown briefly, we will have to have a discussion of the Vashon census data, because that population of students in Vashon, a lot of them are from off island, and what I don't know and haven't seen is a breakdown of racial disparities and racial categories from on-island students versus off-island students. But regardless of the fact, you need the staff of any institution to represent the makeup of who its constituents are.
Mm-hmm. And Gail, you had a comment, and then I think maybe Lynn.
I would just like to say, just from a child development standpoint, I think, you know, there's the obvious, like seeing people who look like me helps me aspire to what I may become. So there's that aspect of it, but there's also a deeper emotional aspect that I am safe. I am in a place where people like me are safe around me. So therefore I am safe. And that maybe even be more important from a developmental standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Lynn?
Really quickly, what I'll say is that we went through that kind of transition when I was at the University of Washington School of Social Work teaching, and we started changing our faculty to better represent the clients that we served, because we did not want to look like modern occupiers or the hegemony of the white or hegemony of the white power structures. And it was interesting, you know, it really did help the students, and it threw the white faculty into sort of a lot of difficult discussions and questions of sharing power, which is good questions in our country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I think that something we'll have to keep an eye on as we move forward. I can tell you, in canvassing and door knocking and showing pictures of Mona Doss, who is now a senator in the state of Washington, to American as of Indian descent, and the appreciation on their face that this is somebody who I believe I can trust because they know about me was so important. So,
okay, right, folks.
Well, until then, we bid everyone adieu and look forward to rejoining next week.
Absolutely. See y'all next week.